more.
Are you ready?
Affirmative consent.
On this side of the dais.
Yeah, you can go sit on the end.
Okay. Committee members, we'll open the House Interim Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection. The date is September 23rd, 2011, and it's shortly after 2 p.m. Our first order of business before we can have a meeting is we have to adopt our committee rules. Every member has a copy of the committee rules. Patrick, I look for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the House Interim Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection adopt the rules as presented, dated 9/21/2011.
Co-Chair Hovey.
No. I'm fine with this.
Jefferson. Okay, Co-Chair Hovey has recommended we adopt the rules for the committee. Any discussions, comments? Seeing none, rules are adopted. Is that correct term? Adopted, yep, adopted.
Correct. Without objection.
Without objection. Thank you very much. Okay, we do have a few important items today as an informational hearing. This is invited testimony only. And we have some friends of mine and Representative Stiegler and maybe Representative Conger that traveled over the mountain, but we have a senator who has another committee. We want to invite Senator Bonamici to come up and please provide us testimony on requirements on debt buyers bringing legal action. Her bill last session, Senate Bill 577. Good afternoon, Senator. Welcome to our committee.
Good afternoon.
Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Did you want just me or did you want anybody else up here at the same time? It's really up to you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Well, we'll let you go first and we'll bring up the two of them.
Thank you. Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Hovey, Vice Co-Chairs, committee members. I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, which is in Washington and Multnomah counties. And last session, I served on the and continue to serve on the Senate Committee on General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection, the committee formerly known as Consumer Protection. And I wanted to talk with you just a bit because you invited me here to talk about Senate Bill 577, which is a bill that I sponsored last session about debt collection practices and debt buyers. And so I thought I'd give you a little bit of background about where the bill came from and the history of the bill and a little bit about the issue, knowing that there are others here as well to talk about debt buyers and debt collection. So just as long time ago background, I worked at Lane County Legal Aid when I was a legal assistant. And one of the things I did there was I worked with people who were struggling to pay bills. And I learned at that time that most of the people were struggling because they either had healthcare bills they couldn't pay or they had lost a job or gone through a divorce. And so I understood at that time when I was working with low-income families that a lot of people who have debt problems are not in trouble because of overspending, but because of circumstances that they can't control. And that tends to be cyclical with, of course, with bad times in the economy when people are struggling. There are more debts that they can't pay, and there are more collection efforts. So after I worked at Legal Aid, I worked at the Federal Trade Commission in Washington, D.C., and the Federal Trade Commission actually enforces the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. So there's two debt collection statutes in that cover Oregon. One of them is the federal, and one of them is the state. Of course, here at the state legislature, we're working with the State Debt Collection Practices Act. And there have been bills in several previous sessions going back before my time to make changes in that Oregon Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Two of them that I'm very familiar with are Senate Bill 328 from 2009, and that's the bill that gives the Attorney General, the Department of Justice, the authority to enforce unfair debt collection practices under our Oregon law. And then there was also a bill, Senate Bill 386, that in 2009 passed the Senate and then did not pass in the House. And Senate Bill 386 made some other changes to debt collection practices. After the 2009 session, I convened a work group to work on debt collection and debt buyer issues. And some of the work group members, I know several of them are in the room, but I'll just give you a summary of who was represented in that group. The Department of Justice, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, members of the representing debt collectors. We also had specific representation for debt buyers. Consumer groups, the Oregon State Bar, the banks, the credit unions, and the Oregon Financial Services Association. And we met over the interim. We had about six meetings between 2009 and 2011. And we crafted Senate Bill 577 through a lot of the input that came from that work group. I have to say that not everybody, of course, in the work group agreed with every part of the bill, but we did make several changes throughout the drafting process based on input from the members of that work group. And so one of the things I wanted to let you know about, because debt buyers are a bit unique, they're not like a regular collection agency, is that in 2010, the Federal Trade Commission issued a report, and this report guided some of our work group work. It's called Repairing a Broken System, Protecting Consumers in Debt Collection, Litigation, and Arbitration. And debt buyers tend to buy large quantities of debt that's typically transferred electronically. And some of the concerns that were raised in debt collection practices in this recent, well, fairly recent 2010 report were these: filing suits based on insufficient evidence, failing to properly notify consumers of suits, high prevalence of default judgments, and for the non-lawyers, default judgment is where somebody just doesn't show up and the judgment is entered against them, either because they didn't know of the lawsuit, they couldn't afford a defense, they didn't know what to do and how to respond to that collection action. And that's fairly typical, especially with smaller amounts that are due, especially people who are struggling financially. They figure they can't afford a lawyer, they don't know where to go, so they just don't show up and then a judgment is entered against them. High prevalence of default judgment, improperly garnishing exempt funds from bank accounts, and some of you may recall that we passed legislation dealing with that issue as well in 2009, and suing or threatening to sue on time-barred debts, in other words, debts where the statute of limitations had run. So those were the issues that were identified on the federal level that we were talking about in our work group. So in Senate Bill 577, we looked also at other states that had passed bills specifically addressing the debt buyer industry. The one at the time that had implemented a statute was North Carolina. Minnesota had one pending. And I just learned recently that several other states have either passed or by legislation or by court rule efforts to address these problems that were identified about debt buyers. And I know Maryland has just joined the growing number of states that demand greater proof from debt buyers before allowing them to recover. They did theirs by court rule. And what they do in Maryland now is require better proof of the debt, a bill or printout showing the purchases, payments, or actual use of the credit card or account by the consumer to show that they actually owe the debt that they're trying to collect. And what happens with some of these debt buyer accounts is that they're so old that the consumer either doesn't remember or they can't find verification that they actually owed the specific amount that's alleged, or they might not even remember the bill. So we had our bill drafted, Senate Bill 577. We had a couple of hearings and a work session on the bill. We did adopt one amendment, so there's an A engrossed version of Senate Bill 577, and then it went to the Senate Rules Committee, where it remains at this point. It did not pass out of the Rules Committee last session. So I'm happy to entertain questions, but what I want to emphasize is that it's especially important to address these issues in difficult economic times when a lot of people are struggling to pay their bills. And just from my experience in helping low-income families, in general, they want to pay their bills that they know that they owe. A lot of them are concerned either because they don't think it's their bill, they can't remember the bill, they don't have evidence that it is the bill, or sometimes they're even victims of identity theft, or somebody with a common name, like Smith, for example.
Or Bonamici.
Probably not. And so what the goal of this legislation was, it did, Senate Bill 577 did make a couple of changes to update the general debt collection practices statute for all collectors, but it also added a section requiring some of the things that the Federal Trade Commission recommended, like better proof of the bill, of the account, notification before a lawsuit, and giving the consumer the notice that the bill the account may be expired by the statute of limitations, and they might want to check into that. And again, we did make several changes based on input from the industry, that the people representing the debt buyers did have some good suggestions, and some of those we incorporated. So I encourage you to, either on the House side or working with the Senate, to continue working on this issue. It's an issue of fairness, especially for low-income and struggling families. And again, it's not to excuse debt that is legitimately owed. It's to allow consumers an opportunity to respond, to have the information that they need to be able to respond, and to make sure that they know what to do when they're notified that a debt buyer is trying to collect a debt. So I'm happy to answer any questions. I know that the Department of Justice has some specific examples of debt buyer calls and collection efforts in this state, but I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Senator. This is an informational hearing, but you are planning on reintroducing the 577A concept in this?
Something like it.
In the 2012.
Yes. There may be changes, obviously, okay. After conversation here and among others in the building.
Thank you.
But yes.
Committee members, you have questions for senators? Co-chair Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So it seems like this is a fairly redundant of what would have gone on before the judgment actually came in. Is that correct? I suppose I should preface this by asking, are most of the debts that are sold, are those judgments?
Co-chairs and Representative Sheehan, not necessarily. And I know that that others may be able to talk a little bit more, but typically they're credit card debts that have not been litigated, or they're not necessarily judgments. They're debts that are not yet judgments. And what happens is that the debt buyer brings the action to get a judgment, but they're not collecting judgments. They're collecting debts, unpaid debts.
Have a quick follow-up, please.
Doesn't the legal process itself have all of the waiting periods, the notice, I know when I've had to go through this process recently with some clients that had eventually declared bankruptcy and left me holding the bag on some bills, so I guess I have a personal bias on some of this stuff. But doesn't this stuff already exist just through the regular legal process, as all of the notice and having to, I noticed there's something in here about a written statement made under oath or affirmation that you serve notice of the debt. I mean, wouldn't that just be a process server doing that to send these guys to court?
Well, there is, of course, the process that somebody goes through to serve notice of a lawsuit. But 577 requires that there be that information given beforehand of an intent to take legal action, so that the consumer has an opportunity to get the information about the details of the alleged debt before the lawsuit.
Is there any data as far as how many people are really unaware of the fact that they have debt once it goes to a debt buyer? This just seems like it's just another way of delaying.
Co-chairs and Representative Sheehan, I don't know if there's data in terms of numbers for Oregon. I know in other jurisdictions they looked at the number of cases that go to a default judgment, and it's significant because especially for smaller amounts, the consumer who's already struggling financially doesn't seek legal assistance and doesn't know where to go to try to defend the action. And it may not be a valid debt. It may be a debt that belongs to somebody else, or it may be a debt that they paid and is erroneously alleged. There's lots of different scenarios. Or it may be a debt that's where the statute of limitations has expired. So it just depends on the circumstances. The goal of this bill is to make sure that the consumer gets as much information as possible so they can determine if they do have a defense or if it is legitimately their debt.
Okay, thank you. Other committee members?
Thank you, Senator, very much.
Have a pleasant weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Next, we'll have Mr. Dobronovich and Mr. Marquis. You want to come up at the same time? Welcome to our beautiful Friday afternoon in the Capitol. Introduce yourself and give us your testimony, please.
Good afternoon. Co-Chair Wisnett, my name is Keith Dobronovich. I am Chief of Staff and Special Counsel at the Oregon Department of Justice. Over the last decade, there's been a substantial growth in the debt collection industry, and a big chunk of that growth has been in the debt buyer section of the industry. And initially, there weren't a lot of problems, but there have been two substantial trends that have been quite problematic for us. And the first is the filing of thousands of lawsuits. And as part of the investigation that we've conducted, we have an informant that told us that his firm filed 300 complaints per week in Multnomah County. Now, in a vacuum, you think, okay, what's the big deal if it's all legitimate debt? But as I'll describe in a moment, a lot of this debt is extremely old debt, barred by the statute of limitations or discharged in bankruptcy. But the debt buyers file these cases, as I said, 300 a week alone in Multnomah County, in an effort to try and get a default judgment that they can then use to go after people's wages and property. That's one of the primary problems that we're seeing. The second is the effort at reviving very old debt. And that is, once debt is barred by the statute of limitations, you can't collect on it, unless you can convince the consumer to pay 10 cents on the debt. And once they have paid any small amount of money, the entire debt becomes reactivated. Now, if most consumers understood that, they, of course, wouldn't pay the 10 cents. They wouldn't revive the debt. But unfortunately, we've had cases of extremely old people that are unaware of that, and they feel obligated to go ahead and pay off their debt. And lo and behold, they've now reactivated an old debt, and it's become much larger than ever before. Debt buyer is not defined anywhere in Oregon law. But as commonly understood, it is where a company or an individual purchases debt, and they collect it just as if they were the original creditor. So they have the same contractual rights and obligations as does the original creditor. One of the problems we found is that these debts are collected, I shouldn't say collected, are organized and traded quite frequently and in oftentimes hundreds or thousands of accounts. So that you're not going out to buy just one account to collect on it. You may buy in bulk 1,000 different accounts that you then go to collect on, and you'll pay pennies on the dollar in the hopes that you get 10 cents on the dollar when you actually collect on it. And part of the problem is that the debt buyers get virtually no information about the debt that they're seeking to collect. They may get the amount of the debt, they may get an account number, but oftentimes that's about all they get. So the debt buyer actually doesn't know anything about who the original creditor is. Is it a Visa account? Is it a Sears account? They may not know that at all. So oftentimes when the consumer makes an inquiry, the person calling them to collect on the debt doesn't know who the debt was originally owed to. And that creates a problem, because if you're the consumer and somebody says you owe $50, the first question you want to have answered is, who do I owe the money to and for what? And oftentimes the debt buyer does not have that information. So let me give you some examples of debt buyer problems that we've seen. a man here in the Salem area who lives on Social Security received a collection letter and repeated invoices on a debt that was owed by a construction company over 25 years ago, obviously barred by the statute of limitations. Similarly, an 85-year-old woman in Bend started getting three calls a day from a debt from 1995, likewise long barred by the statute of limitations. A lady in Gresham, her son received a telephone call and was told that there was a warrant out for his mother's arrest and that her car was going to be impounded unless she paid the debt immediately. We find these things over and over again. A Clackamas County resident had a debt that was discharged in bankruptcy 9 years ago, clearly barred by limitations, but it was discharged in bankruptcy court. So the debt was long gone and is not properly collectible. A woman in Canby filed a complaint with us against an Atlanta-based debt buyer for attempting to collect on a $300 debt that she had paid off 2 years earlier. She actually had a letter from the company that said she had paid off her debt in full. She provided that information to the debt buyer, and instead of closing their file, they then started contacting this woman's mother and saying that there was a fraud case against her in Clackamas County Circuit Court. We are working on a case involving an elderly couple from Redmond. They filed a complaint with us after they initially received a mailing from a debt buyer that resembled an invoice, and they didn't know what it was. So they contacted the company, and they were told that they owed a business more than $800. And they said, well, what business? And the caller refused to identify the creditor, and the caller made no effort at clarifying that the people they were calling in Redmond actually owed the money. Well, when we got involved, we started investigating, and the debt buyer conceded that, you know, they really did have the wrong debtor, and that during a search for the correct consumer, the complainant's name, the people in Redmond, their name came up and possibly their phone number was provided in error. So these poor folks in Redmond who never owed the debt were being harassed and challenged to pay the debt that was never theirs in the first place. We've also had a number of cases of lawsuits being filed on debt that had been paid in full. A Hillsborough woman, for example, was sued by a debt buyer in October of 2009 after she had fully paid off the debt 4 months earlier. And again, she had a receipt for the full payment, but she still got sued. She showed the confirmation to the company and said, look, I've paid it. And the next thing she knew, she got a demand letter seeking payment for $10,000. And when she asked for information about who she owed the money to, she was told it's creditor number 780-497-4371-495090. Well, that obviously meant nothing to her. If the company had said, you owe $100 to Sears, that would have meant something to her. But because the number didn't make any sense, she didn't feel like she owed the money. And next thing she knew, she got sued on a debt that she had actually been paid off. So those are the examples that certainly, unfortunately, are not rare. We, as I mentioned earlier, have a large number of complaints about debt collection practices. They remain in the top 10 at the Department of Justice, and unfortunately at the Federal Trade Commission, the number of complaints involving debt collection practices has skyrocketed tenfold in the last 10 years. Now, admittedly, some of that is a result of more debt being owed than ever before, but the fact of the matter is that some of these practices are illegal, and we are doing all we can to try and correct these companies' conduct. I'm happy to answer your questions.
I think what I'll do, sir, is have Mr. Marquis testify, and then the committee have questions of both of these gentlemen. Mr. Marquis, please identify yourself. Thank you for making the trip up from the coast. I hope you get back soon.
Thank you. Co-chairs, staff, members of the committee, I'm Jim Marquis. I represent the Oregon Collectors Association, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I think it's good to look at these issues. I have provided you some written testimony which gives some background on debt collection practices in Oregon and the regulatory process and a little bit about case law. And I'd like to go through that a little bit. I want to make very, very clear at the outset, I don't represent debt buyers. The Oregon Collectors Association is a small organization, Oregon-based, affiliated with ACA International, which is a national company that does have a division that represents some debt buyers. But we don't have any in Oregon. We don't also represent collection agencies that are domiciled elsewhere. So we have about 60 small businesses in Oregon that make their living collecting legitimate debts owed to mostly Oregon residents. I would just say at the outset that as Mr. Dubanovich talks about complaints at the Attorney General's office, we look at 700 or 800 complaints a year at the Department of Justice for third-party debt collectors, and about 10% of those are on our members in Oregon consistently. And in the latest year that we checked, there were 719 complaints, and at the Department of Justice, we had, I think, about 70 of those complaints against our members. And in that year, we had 2.5 million debtor contacts. I would put that record up against any industry in the country. I mean, it's unbelievable that we would have that few complaints in this kind of contentious situation, because most of these people aren't happy they're getting the call. So I just want to say that, defending my client a little bit, we aren't debt buyers. Occasionally we do have some of our clients occasionally have one of their clients, one of our collection agencies will have one of their clients that wants to sell some debt, and they might buy a small amount of debt. Generally speaking, documentation of those kinds of debts that are purchased by our members is just not a problem because they have the contract or they have the stuff. Now, I've been representing these guys for 36 years in this building, so I know something about the history of debt collection and debt collection statutes. When Congress enacted the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, it was first introduced as the Annunzio Bill, 1976 or 77, and it included regulation of everybody that collected a debt. But the banks quickly said, we don't do that, let us out. And the credit union said, we don't do that, let us out. And they exempted everybody except collection agencies. And so the bill moved forward and became law and regulated collection agencies only. The Oregon legislature responded with a bill that we supported, and we created the Oregon Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. And the difference was that it applied to anybody collecting a debt in Oregon. First party, third party, we didn't care. If you're collecting a debt, you ought to play by the same rules. I remember Mr. Bronner, representing the Bankers Association at the time, was not very happy with me about that. But we believed that everybody ought to play by the same rules. The two laws were very similar in nature in those days. The two laws have changed dramatically over the years. And in some ways, the federal law has become outdated a little bit. ACA International has recently created a blueprint to move forward, we're asking at the national level for Congress to update the federal law, and we'll be presenting you with that blueprint as we move toward the February session, and you'll have an opportunity to look at some of the ideas that we're talking about in terms of modernizing the Debt Collection Act at the federal level. The reason I think that's important to mention is that as we tried to work with Senator Bonamici on her legislation of the last couple of sessions, a lot of what she wanted to do was to make some portions of the Oregon law more like the federal law, and it made, you know, it sounded like it made some sense to have the two laws the same. Unfortunately, The laws are extremely different, and you can't take just one piece of them and make them the same. If you're going to make them the same, you make them the same. Senator Bonamici advanced a proposal to, for instance, extend the statute of limitations in Oregon beyond the 1 year that's in the Oregon law. But that's the same as the federal law now, 1 year. So there was a certain level of inconsistency in that we had some problems with. But I do think that Senator Bonamici has worked hard to try to bring these. There are some real problems that she's brought some focus to that I think it's good to talk about. Under the Oregon Act, anybody collecting a debt in Oregon is subject now to regulation, not only as the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, but a violation of that is also a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act under Chapter 646 and is subject to the purview and regulation of the Attorney General. There's also a right of private action available, $200 or actual damages together with punitives, attorney fees, etc. I would just say that under Attorney General Kroger's policies and procedures, we've had an excellent relationship with their agency. We have a committee that meets with them on a fairly regular basis and talk about what the problems that are out there, and if there are any problems with our members, which thankfully there haven't been any real problems with our members so far, but we really think they're doing a good job. Also, the Department of Consumer and Business Services licenses collection agencies. They do not enforce the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, but they do enforce a licensing act. And collection agencies in Oregon are required to issue post a $10,000 bond. They're required to keep records, to remit to their clients in a timely manner, et cetera, et cetera. Most of those laws are there to protect the clients of collection agencies rather than the debtors. We have advocated that Department of Consumer Business Services have full authority to revoke a license if there are violations over under the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, and we've encouraged more coordination of activity between the two agencies. Under the former Attorney General, the two agencies barely spoke to each other, and to both agencies' credit, they're doing a much better job of coordinating activity now, and we laud them for those efforts. I talked a little bit about complaints, so I'm not going to go into that again. But I do want to talk about impacts of lawsuits under some case law that relates to the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. This act sets out all of the do's and don'ts that you can do when you're collecting a debt. You can't harass somebody, you can't do this, you can't do that. The standard of conduct under this says that you may not willfully violate the act. So we need to look at what is the definition of willful under this act. And under an old case, State versus Redden, Redden versus Discount Fabrics, in which, interestingly enough, my friend Paul Romaine was the lead attorney for the Attorney General's office when he worked for Department of Justice doing this case. This case was brought against Discount Fabrics, and the court said that under this act, willful is no more than proof of ordinary negligence by a defendant in not knowing when it should have known. And so this actually brought into these cases a standard of ordinary negligence. And if you didn't know something you should have known, you violated the act. Well, that's different than what we think the legislature meant by willful initially. And it's a much lower bar. And so because of that ordinary negligence standard that we think exists in the law and seems to have been proven time and again in courts, it's very, very imperative that you move cautiously in changing these laws about how one should act under the Act, because somebody can make a mistake and be in violation. And believe me, there are lots of young lawyers out there ready to sue collection agencies for an alleged violation of the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. And just as litigation has grown in the debt collection arena, litigation has grown with lawyers suing debt collectors for violations of these acts, oftentimes technical kinds of violations. The other case I just want to bring to your to you is the Porter case. And this was a case in which Porter was a lawyer who had a client that owed him $26,000, and it was a disputed debt, and the client didn't believe he owed $26,000, and the lawyer sued him for the debt. The court ruled in Porter that the filing of a legal action on a debt that is for the wrong amount, or even for a debt that is not owed, is not necessarily a violation of the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act in and of it by itself, because they said that is the proper venue to address those kinds of issues, the courts. And so it is not a violation of the Act to sue, not necessarily a violation of the Act, to sue for the wrong amount, because you might have miscalculated interest or whatever. Well, if you couple, there are people who say, well, if you sue on a debt that doesn't exist, or if you sue for the wrong amount, that should be a violation. But remember, you go back to this ordinary negligence standard, and if I miscalculated interest and made a mistake of $8 or $9 on interest, and I sued you for that wrong amount, and it was a violation of this Act, then you come back with a right of civil action and potential civil penalties under the Attorney General's office. So as we look at that issue of suing for the wrong amount or suing on a debt that wasn't owed, I simply say be cautious, because it is much more complicated than at first blush it would seem. Now, with respect to debt buyers specifically, I said I don't represent them. There are people in the room that do represent them. There's an attorney in the room who does a lot of defense work for debt buyers. There's a gentleman who represents an association of debt buyers. And I'm sure at future dates or whenever you think is appropriate, they'll be happy to address concerns that they may have specifically about debt buyers. I would say debt buying is a fairly new industry. I think a lot of credit card companies and the like discovered that when internally they didn't collect something and they assigned it to a collection agency and they failed to collect it, they were sitting with a lot of debt, huge amounts of debt, and they figured out they could bundle it up and sell it to somebody for 3 or 4 cents on the dollar, and those folks would go out and collect what they could. Sometimes that same debt gets sold a second or third time. In fact, in today's world, there are brokers who buy debt on a national scale and who then will break that debt into zip codes and then sell portions of it off. So they might buy it at 3 cents on the dollar nationally and then break it into zip codes and sell it to smaller entities that buy debt in their local region for 5 cents on the dollar. And so what's the issue? The issue is documentation. If I were going to, if you were going to buy debt, the price of the debt would depend on, you would price it by looking at the age of the accounts, the average balance of the accounts, how much documentation there were, the total amount that you were looking at, and the type of debt. And so documentation comes into play. We have a principle in this country that if I'm going to sue you for a debt, I have to give you some evidence that you owe me the money. And I have to be able to show that to the court. And we shouldn't abandon that principle, certainly. The question is, how do we document and at what level? And Senate Bill 577 had some problems for many people with the information that was required to be submitted and with the notice of, I have to give you a 30-day notice before I sue you, 30-day intent. Well, my guys would like to have 30 days notice before those lawyers sue them for a violation, too. But so there are some problems in the what would be required under documentation. And I think the heart of the matter is talking about the original contract or the original account number. If you think in terms of your credit card, how many years have you had it? Where would the original contract be, and what would the original account number be on a credit card that you took out 20 years ago? It's problematic at best. So those are issues that certainly we can talk about as we move forward. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you both, gentlemen. Committee members, questions for these two witnesses, please? Chair Hovey.
Thanks. I had a question for Mr. Dubanovich, sort of getting back to the bill and the idea about providing the notice and the documentation of the debt that's actually purported to be owed. Have any other states implemented legislation similar to this, outside of the federal issues?
Yes. Co-Chair Wisnett. Co-Chair Hulvey, a couple of states have adopted a bill quite similar to 577. Some states have adopted rules, court rules, that require the contract and debt verification to be attached to the lawsuit complaint when it's filed. And there's a little bit of a conflict between Oregon law and federal law, and that's on the verification of the debt. Federal law requires that if the consumer wants information about the debt, they have a right to know the amount of the debt, who the creditor is, they have a right to dispute the debt, they have a right to request verification. The problem is that we in the Oregon Department of Justice don't have any ability to enforce the federal act. And so there are companies that simply thumb their nose at the federal act, recognizing that state authorities aren't going to do anything, and the federal authorities are unlikely to do it if it's, you know, a one-off or individual collector in a small state. So what some states have done is they said, if you violate the federal act, you are per se in violation of the state act. So in essence, we would be adopting the validation requirements of the federal act. And that's what I think it's Pennsylvania. I'm sorry, Minnesota that did that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Other committee members' questions? Well, this is obviously that we'll see if the senator reintroduces this and it goes to her committee or comes over here, but there's other. I think Mr. Marquis mentioned that we'd want to talk to the debt collecting people too and get their input. So again, I think it's a very interesting topic, and we'll see what happens in February as the senator introduces it. Thank you very much for your testimony on this, your input to us on this consumer protection issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Committee members, we'll now have invited testimony on kennel and grooming registration in House Bill 2470 in the 2011 session. Representative Stiegler introduced. Representative, will you please come up and introduce the topic, and we'll have some other guests to testify. Good morning or good afternoon. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Co-Chair Swisnett and Co-Chair Hulvey. I'm, for the record, my name is Judy Stiegler. I'm from Bend, Oregon, great city of Bend. And I appreciate, first of all, I want to extend my appreciation to you all for, I guess, looking at this piece of legislation again, or this topic. I think it's an important area. This first came to me back in 2009 by some constituents of Representative Wisnett. We didn't figure that out till at a later time. At any rate, John and Karen Burton, who had a very unfortunate situation occur in their lives, in that they had had a dog that had been boarded at a kennel, and that dog had been severely abused, which ultimately resulted in that dog having to be put to sleep. Probably, I think it was about a year later. But Zoe was the name of the dog, and I'll pass out some written testimony of the Burtons here in a few minutes, and you'll see a picture of Zoe. So that's how this issue first came to my attention. It was through concerned constituents. And I met with the Burtons and a group of interested folks, including Dr. Kettering, who is a veterinarian in Bend, and other interested pet owners in and around Central Oregon. And we proceeded to talk about what might be able to be done on a legislative level. What became very obvious to me after doing some initial research on this is that this was an area that really didn't have much in the way of any kind of standards or any kind of regulation on a statewide basis. You'll remember back in 2009 there were some more specific restrictions that were passed with respect to breeders, but it did not apply to dog kennels, boarding kennels, groomers, that sort of whole genre of people where they take their dogs and their cats and probably other pets to be taken care of when they're away or when they're out of town, whatever. So it became pretty apparent that we needed to do something beyond just hope that, you know, people would, of goodwill would prevail and kennels and groomers would do the right thing, because it became pretty obvious in this event that the particular situation that the kennel had not done due diligence with respect to the particular person, their employee, who had actually perpetrated the abuse on the animal. There is currently pending a criminal case and a civil case, but my goal was to try to set some basic standards for care of these facilities, and to do it in such a way that was neither grossly intrusive on the business end of things, but would ensure a minimal standard of protection so that the consumer could go into one of these facilities and rest fairly assured that their pets were going to receive the care that they assumed they would. So we embarked on a process, and I sent this group out. I said, look, I don't have staff and I don't have the ability to do all the kind of research that needs to be done in an event regarding a situation like this, so you go out. I mean, I'm sure that there are other states that have legislation that regulates, sets some minimum standards, that kind of thing, and this group did, and particularly the Burtons, did a lot of research on a variety of states that have legislation, brought that information to me, and at which point I set about working with legislative counsel, Mr. Taylor up there, who he and I went back and forth numerous times putting this legislation together. Again, with a focus trying to be to set some minimum standards of care, some way of the least amount of intrusive regulation possible, but acknowledging folks, you know, people's pets mean a lot to them. I'm sure we all have either personally or had friends or family who have had a dog, a cat, who knows that, but those pets become members of the family. And one of the things I wanted to do was to make sure as well, understanding the economic impact that over intricate regulations would have on any state entity or public entity having to enforce these regulations or these standards, that I wanted to try to come up with something that was minimal from a fiscal standpoint vis-a-vis whatever that agency would be. In working with Mr. Taylor, it became apparent that probably the Department of Agriculture was the appropriate venue from a state agency perspective as to where the responsibility should lie. And if you look through this House Bill 2471 as it's currently constructed, and I would add here too that I also worked with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association or Veterinary Medicine Association to try to address some of their concerns, and I believe they had drafted an amendment to that, or to 2471. At any rate, it became apparent that Department of Agriculture was the best place to go, and with the fiscal constraints in mind, we tried to set up a process that would involve a minimal amount of extra work on the part of that agency. If you look at the legislation, for instance, they need to develop and post on a website what the rules and regulations, the standards are, what the minimum standards are, and those kinds of things, as well as any final orders for those cases that they found where there have been violations of the various components of 2471. So, and then we wanted to also be mindful of an undue financial burden on the businesses as well. And you'll note in here there's nothing that requires anything beyond what these businesses already have to do as far as licensing. In other words, they don't have to go through some template of a checklist to then become a licensed facility under the eyes of the state. We didn't even go there with this. And there are some states that have that kind of, impose those kind of regulations. So I tried to be mindful of the fiscal impact on the businesses as well, but mindful that these are businesses that are, that are dealing with living, breathing entities, people's pets. I wanted to, there's some onus on their part that they do need to meet some minimum standards, as well as they need to make sure that the people that are employed by them to take care of these animals are not people who have had previous issues, like been convicted of animal abuse or anything like that. So in vetting the various minimum standards that got implemented in or got put into this legislation, again, we went across the board these various states that have similar or have existing statutes regarding this topic and tried to pick out, again, to set at least a minimum floor for how these facilities should be operating. And I think if you look at the requirements in there, there is nothing that is terrifically onerous. Now, the Oregon Veterinary Association has brought to my attention an issue regarding stacking cages. I'm totally open to, other professionals coming in and having some input on what might be some rational and reasonable tweaking of some of these provisions in here. But again, I was very emphatic with Mr. Taylor that we didn't, mindful that of the financial issues as well as on both sides of the fence, as well as that this was sort of new territory for Oregon. I wanted to try to be as reasonable about the approach as possible. I have to applaud the Burtons and their group. They did a lot of the homework and the legwork with respect to all of this. You'll note one thing in there. We did not create a registry. This was a big issue of debate with myself and the group and with Mr. Taylor as to whether it would be something similar to the sex abuse registry. It would be an animal abuse registry. Under the circumstances, this is one of those kind of situations where I think getting at the ground floor level, the standards implemented and operational for a period of time, let's see how things work and if we need to go that direction. Our response to that instead was to have final orders of violations posted on the website of the Department of Agriculture. So it's not the best of all situations, but it does minimize keeping one of those registries keeping those up can become quite cumbersome and quite expensive for the entities that are charged with that responsibility. So we didn't do that. We sort of did this, as I said, this quasi-registry, but i.e., any founded final order would be posted on a website so that if anybody was interested, they could go do their due diligence and go on the Department of Ag's website themselves. So that isn't in there. We also, Mr. Taylor brought to my attention in the drafting process that one of the things, our statute, if you, most of these, this is all in 167, mostly the 300 area, and it's part of our criminal statutes. They talk about, I think the term is, let me look here, make sure I got the right thing. They talk about the, an owner. And the definition was pretty, narrow. It refers to, and the definition was relatively narrow. And one of the issues that came up during all our discussions was, would the definition as it now stands in statute extend to, for instance, say you don't take your dog to a kennel, but you leave your dog with you know, your neighbor to take care of, and come back and you've got a very severely injured dog. So we broadened the definition in that respect, and purely it doesn't, if you look at it, it doesn't apply to most of these other sections that apply to kennels and the grooming places like that. It's specifically with respect to existing definitions within the criminal statutes. So we did do that. And what I did was I went last December to the Consumer Practices or the Consumer Affairs Committee, Consumer Affairs and Government Accountability is what it was called then, and talked with Rep. Holvey, Representative Holvey at that point, because I knew I was not going to, I needed somehow to get it pushed forward the last session. So he graciously agreed to take it to the committee at that time, and they adopted it as a committee bill and put it forward in that respect. It would be my hope going into what I assume is probably the next regular session, not the February short session, because I know that there are a lot of restrictions and constraints, but that the committee sees that this is a timely and important enough topic that it, you know, I like I said, there's no absolute pride of authorship in 2471. The concept is very, I think, very strong and very timely, and it is an issue that we need to attend to. And I would hope that the committee would see some way, shape, or form to be able to pursue this and bring it forward, again, if not to February, then in the 2013 regular session. That's my hope in that regard. So I'm happy to answer any questions anybody might have.
Thank you, Representative Stigler. Committee members, questions?
Representative Vice Chair Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very quick one. On page 3, line 12, it says it's not stacked or though it's placed above or below any other dog enclosure. I'm just trying to picture this. When I go to my vet, there's typically a wall of enclosures. How does that fit into this?
Co-chairs Wisnett and Holvey and Representative Sheehan. First of all, the first answer to that is it would not apply to veterinary facilities. If the amendment that they have proposed is incorporated as part of any future legislation, so it exempts veterinary facilities. They're already this issue was brought to my attention. It was never my intent that this legislation should address veterinary facilities. They're already very highly regulated and have all sorts of standards, et cetera. So this would not directly affect your vet. But taking that a step further, this is an issue which Mr. Kolb and Ms. Smith brought to my attention. And it could very, there are rational reasons to allow the stacking, and I think that this was included in, as I said, I took to Mr. Taylor a notebook, which I think is
I think Representative Holby still has, I'm not positive, his office, but of other state statutes, and you know, this was sort of an amalgam of that, and stacking cages was one of the things that was in another state's legislation that was incorporated in there, and when it was originally brought to my attention, I said, yeah, that sounds reasonable and rational, but since then, again, Mr. Kolb and them have brought to my attention that this, there are logical reasons to allow stacking of cages. I think the issue on our in our minds was, you know, you don't have some poor animal down at the bottom who's, you know, getting defecated on and urinated on, too, that there has to be a way to do that. And I'm assuming that, you know, that issue can be met.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yes.
And I was wondering about, it's a, you just target dogs here. What about other animals?
Well, actually, the only section that does apply specifically to dogs is Section 6.
That's enclosure.
Yeah, and that was brought to my attention as well. But the remaining provisions apply to pets in general. It would be cat hotels. It would be any of those kind of things. So minimum standards is just with respect to dogs themselves, we want to be very, very specific about some of the, you know, that they may require certain things that other animals do not. So there's sort of like two sets of minimum standards here. There's the minimum, and then there's slightly elevated standards for in Section 6 for the for dogs. So cats are not excluded. If you look to the, you know, general definition of domestic animals, it would be your ferret. It would be, you know, I'm assuming birds or anything. I'm not aware of. I know there are cat hotels, and I know that there are boarding cat, and I'm sure that there are facilities for other forms of pets.
And stacking, the stacking rule applies to the cat hotels and.
Yes. Yeah, and so again, as I said, there's no pride of authorship here. I'm more than happy to, you know, I would just like to get at least a baseline here of requirements and standards that make some sense, and so that there's some expectation. The other thing I would add in here too, one of the obligations on the part of the facility, two primary things other than the meeting the minimum standards, but is to have a sort of a notification that my vision would be, you know, you take something down off the website of what the Department of Ag has set out for, and here's information where you can go if you think there's been a violation and that kind of thing. And then the other thing is to run a criminal background check on their employees to make sure that, you know, we're not getting somebody that's been convicted of one of these crimes that's actually taking care of your pets, or even, you know, that raises a suspicion. I mean, I think people who have any interaction with the criminal justice system know the story that if you have somebody who's prone to abusing animals, they're probably prone to abusing people and children, and, you know, and vice versa. So, I mean, the whole idea there is to not, as to have some safety valve, I guess, in that regard.
Okay, thank you. Representative Conger, you had a question?
It's not a question. I just wanted to say that I really appreciate your willingness to drive over here and to stick with these issues. It's not the only one that I've seen you do this with. It's obviously an issue that's near and dear to your heart. You're doing this on, you know, a volunteer basis, even more so than when you were in the legislature, and I really respect and admire that about you and wanted to say thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Representative, very much. I
do appreciate it. Any other questions, comments, committee members? Chair Helvey?
Just one real quick. Thanks for bringing this back up. The notebook, I'll have to.
Yeah.
I don't know.
He thought I had. I said, no, I think I gave it to Representative Holby's office. We'll
and I think you have it.
That.
So.
Yeah,
but anyway, really I just, bad. You know, for explanation, we, you know, there are a couple pieces in this bill probably I think need some work.
Absolutely.
I'm a little concerned about fiscal impact in the penalty versions of the bill as well, because that could have some major impacts to the bill. But, you know, just for full disclosure, this bill, although introduced by this committee,
right,
was not assigned to this committee.
No.
And so it was very late in session that the Judiciary Committee decided, oh, well, let's give it back to this committee, and by that time, Representative Wisnett and I had a full agenda and no time left to put this in, so apologize for that.
And co-chairs Wisnett and Holby, I absolutely understand and appreciate the intricacies of scheduling legislation during the session. I honestly appreciate just the fact that we can revisit this, and again, my hope is that we can take it forward.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative. I think we've last now with Mr. John and Karen Burton and Sherry Hanna come up, please. I think they've had some examples they'd like to discuss. We appreciate public testimony, people traveling over to.
And I'm going to be going to the committee assistant the written testimony.
Please, anyway, and welcome to your capital.
Thank you.
We're sorry you have to come and testify on something like this. We ask you to please identify yourself before you start your testimony. And go ahead.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Wisnett and Co-Chair Holby and members of the committee. My name is Karen Burton, and I'm from Bend, Oregon. Zoe was our beautiful and vibrant six-year-old collie who was a family member. Zoe was no different than a child to us. We celebrated her birthdays, we took her on vacations with us, and we played with her and we bonded with her. Zoe was formally trained. She was loving, she was intelligent, and she could be very stoic. Her stoicism made it difficult to initially determine the extent of her injuries. She survived her beating but could not overcome the tremendous internal injuries that were caused. As a result, I was her caretaker for the next very intense 10 months leading to her death. I take pride in the fact that I am a native Oregonian, and through my experience as a pet owner and Zoe's caretaker, I believe in the value of protecting our pets. I believe we have a moral and an ethical responsibility to protect all those who cannot defend themselves against abuse, torture, and neglect. The tragedy here is on many fronts, but what stands out to me is that we had so little information on which to make our decisions before and after Zoe's incident. Regardless if Zoe was an animal or a human, she was somebody we loved very much. She was a member of the family, and she was needlessly and traumatically taken from us. And I want to thank you for your time and listening to our story today.
Thank you very much, Karen. John, go ahead.
My name is John Burton. I'm from Bend, Oregon. Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holby, members of the committee. I think, as Karen just illustrated, the life and death of Zoe definitely changed the trajectory of our lives. We didn't choose the course of events, certainly, but while Zoe was alive, we turned to her and dedicated ourselves to helping others and their pets in similar situations. As Zoe's injuries became more alarming, I particularly remember that Saturday. The sheriff's substation was closed. The veterinarian office was closed. The local Humane Society could offer some support, but not enough to satisfy us. Like Zoe, I think we have some idea what it feels like to be alone and what it feels like to be helpless. Eventually, there was a sheriff's investigation, although it got off to a rather slow start. Unfortunately, Zoe, our key witness, could not speak for herself, and so we are here today to speak for her. We've taken two courses of action, a criminal and a civil trial. They have yet to be unresolved, and we're going into the third year of both. At the time of the incident, we were totally unprepared for what had happened. We thought that we were given some protection based on the sticker in the window of the kennel that day that read the American Kennel and Boarding Association. I've been in contact with their director since, and it's clear that there's no real protection from that particular group of people. They are a set of suggested guidelines only. The even turning the kennel ahead of time didn't help. We waited a full 5 years before we even attempted to take Zoe to a kennel, because we had some trepidation that something might happen based on other people's stories. We, though, have sought other avenues of meaning to this whole thing. We've written in local publications. We established a website that we still maintain today. The website really has three purposes. It's to inform people, to educate them, and to hopefully provide some kind of proactive ideas so that they're not as lost as we were. I would say that far too many people in Bend and from across the state of Oregon have come to me and shared their stories of horror and abuse in kennels. The injuries usually take the form of blunt force trauma to the head or the side, loss of limb, and more tragically, the loss of life. I'd like you to take into consideration all that we've said today and help our pets be safe. In the name of Zoe and in the name of all sentient beings. And I would be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, John. We'll hear from we'll hear from Sherry first, and then we'll have questions. The three of you. Thank you.
Thanks. Hey, my name is Sherry Hanna, and I'm from Bend, Oregon. Co-chair Winslet and co-chair Bowman, members. I first learned about Zoe's plight when I read the article in the Bend Bulletin. I immediately emailed John to share with him our story. Same kennel, different owners. And this was in 2001. We took our three poodle pointers, who had all been through hunting school, been through obedience school, to the same kennel. When we came back after a long weekend, we picked up the dogs, we took them home, everybody was happy, but I noticed Hunter was not acting right. He couldn't close his left, or he kept closing his left eye, and he just acted very quiet, which was not Hunter. We took him to the vet the next day, and Hunter had blunt force trauma to the head. We also had him evaluated by an ophthalmologist, and again, he concurred with Dr. Susan Loomis's stating that he had blunt force trauma to the head. We went out to the kennel and talked to the owners. They denied everything. After we got our diagnosis, we went back out to the kennel and again talked to the owners, and they denied everything. Hunter did not have blunt force trauma to the head before we took him to the kennel. When I told my workout partner the other day that I would not be at work working out with her Friday today, and I told her why. She said, I just had two friends that got their dogs out of kennels. One came home with a hole in his side, and one came home with a lump on his head. So this is still continuing, and we need to do something. I hope that you can help us find a remedy for this situation, and I thank you for your time.
Thank all three of you for your testimony. I know it's tough. All of us, I'm a dog lover. My wife is twice as much as me. But I think also I'd like to comment that I think it's real important that you've taken the initiative to try to work with Representative Stegler and try to come up with a solution. That's important to us as legislators, that we have citizens involved and want to create legislation. We'll try to work with you and see what we can do. Committee members, questions of these three witnesses, please.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Greg.
Just a brief comment. And I've had two dogs, English Bulldogs, and each lived, you know, long lives. And now my daughters, this coming Wednesday, are going to be sisters to a new little English Bulldog. But my point is, we've kind of delayed the decision because it's a big responsibility. People that make the commitment based on, can we raise this child? I mean, really, quite honestly, that's how most people view their animals, and particularly dogs. And so to me, when a business goes out there and says, we will take care of your most precious family member or a family member, it just seems like they should act accordingly. And so I appreciate you coming to do that and coming forward, but also Representative Stegler, it's always great to see you, and your grandkids are fine in my district. But thanks for continuing to march with this, and I sure hope we can get somewhere and get through whatever bumps there might be so that we can pass legislation that's good for Oregon. Thank you for your time, and thanks for coming.
Thank you, Representative Matthews. Other committee members, questions? Again, thank you for traveling over, and we'll continue to look at this issue and see what we can work out. I think it's something we need to address, and we'll see if we can do it, put some policy out there to protect those four-legged loved ones.
Thank you.
Thank you. Safe travels home. I'm going to ask Mr. Kolb and Dr. Kettingley, please come up, please. Who's here in the Department of Agriculture? Would you like to come up in case we want to ask questions? You don't have to testify. Someone's here from the Department of Agriculture?
Yeah.
You set up here, and if you have no, if you don't wish to make some comments, you'd be here for questions. We'll have to identify. Thank you very much for coming to the committee this afternoon. You come up, set up, and we'll go ahead and introduce yourself, Mr. Cobb. And,
I was going to have Dr. Kettering speak first, if that's okay.
Thank you. Go ahead, Dr. Kettering.
Good afternoon. Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holvey, I'm Dr. Jody Kettering. I am a general practitioner from Bend, Oregon. I've been practicing for almost 13 years. I'm a co-owner of our practice in Bend. I can tell you right off the bat, this is probably one of the most moving cases I've been involved in. My background certainly at this time is general practice, but I do have strictly emergency medicine experience. I worked in Seattle for almost 3 years doing emergency medicine. Saw a lot of pretty horrific injuries, and this was by far the worst. And to find out that this occurred at a boarding kennel was quite a shock. Although I will say we do from time to time have phone calls from boarding facilities that will call with concerns. Pets have an injury, they may not be eating, they may be vomiting, indigestion type problems, diarrhea, that sort of thing. Not very often though. Most times we see patients after they've come home from the kennel. There's been something that's occurred, or the most common thing is indigestion. But frankly, we don't hear a lot about these sorts of incidences. From a practical standpoint, as far as my interest in promoting this bill is, number one, animal welfare is what I do. That's part of my job as a veterinarian. I have taken an oath to promote humane treatment, end suffering when I can, and basically be a voice for my patients and those that can't speak. So that, first and foremost, is my number one reason for becoming involved. We also have a lot of clients that ask us, where should I board my pet? And frankly, I've never boarded my dogs. I've always been fortunate they've gone with us, or I've had people that have come in and stayed at my house, so I've been pretty lucky. But I've never been comfortable saying, oh, go here, or take your pet there, because I don't really know what their standards are. My clients are paying for these people to take care of their pets in their absence, and there's an assumed general standard or guidelines in place that you think would be there, but sadly they're not. And so I have to say I do not recommend boarding facilities in our area at all. I try to work with clients to find alternatives, and I would like to support that service. I think there's obviously a great need for it, but I can't consciously or, you know, ethically recommend that at all. And then just on a record-keeping level, if a boarding facility is to keep fairly decent records, we're not asking for it to be super involved, but it would be nice to know if the pet, when the last time they ate was, have they been eating? Have they been depressed? Have they been withdrawn? Have they been vomiting? Have they been, you know, producing unusual stools? Did they receive the medications that were brought there with the owners, with the pet, by the owners? When I do, in these rare times, see pets because they were having problems at the kennel, I will say that most times they shrug their shoulders and say, we don't know, or, well, we think they ate, or they give you a funny look and say, yeah, I think they got all their medication. So certainly, just in the sense of record keeping, it would be extremely helpful for me working through the problems, making an accurate diagnosis, and being able to treat these pets that I see that have had problems at a boarding facility. I want to thank you for seeing us and for allowing us to come over and give you testimony. It's been a long few years, and this is very rewarding. And I just want to thank you again.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Claude.
Thank you, Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Kolb. I'm executive director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, and I do want to let you know I am not a veterinarian. I'm hired staff by the organization. I'm going to comment and kind of give a framework of how we looked at the bill and respond to a couple of things that former Representative Stiegler had commented on. But I guess first and foremost, I want to convey my belated sympathies to the Burdens. I have an old guy, a 14-year-old Golden, who's, I hate to say it, but his better days are behind him. And as I think about his more end stage of life, a little closer, and then preparing for this hearing here, just made me think of what the Burtons experienced. And I just wanted to say I'm sorry for their loss. When we first was introduced about House Bill 2471, our association, along with our the American Veterinary Medical Association, it's our national group and one of the largest in the world, we took a look at the language in the bill and had some concerns because we thought the way it was written, it possibly could include veterinary practices. And as a point of reference, veterinary practices, a number of them do provide grooming services, and many, if not most, or almost all of them, at one time or another will kennel a dog, board a dog for an indeterminate period of time, often as a service to clients who are out on vacation. And so we met with former Representative Stiegler to discuss our concerns about the legislation, and she did let us know that she was not interested or they weren't looking to include veterinary practices. She graciously agreed about accepting an amendment. We had worked on one, and we believed that was going to introduce that, but the bill did not go anywhere, so that's where we're here today. And we understand the reasons for that, too. I mean, our hope is that if similar legislation is to be introduced in 2013, that practices would be exempt. From our conversation with Ms. Stiegler, we did learn that boarding kennels and grooming parlors are not really regulated, and that we believe that some form of registration or oversight should be looked at, and it may very well be appropriate, and indeed appropriate. You know, veterinary medicine is quite different in the sense that we are a regulated profession. In our state, the Oregon Veterinary Medical Examining Board is a licensing agency for veterinarians and certified technicians. They've established standards of care. These are pretty well accepted across. Every state has standards of care. Minimum standards of care include the treatment and medical attention given to animals, but also appropriate behavior and training and handling of animals as well. In addition, the AVMA has pretty well established principles and guidelines, ethical principles. We realize these are not binding, but there are guidelines that have been accepted by the profession and sets a high bar for the profession. And then ongoing education is also part of the professionalism of veterinary medicine. And I'll give you just two examples. Earlier this year, we had two of the leading authorities in the country come to our annual conference in March at the Veterinary College to talk about animal neglect and animal abuse, more about the identification, documentation of abuse, why it's important, what the role of the profession is, and why that is important. And then also, our annual conference has had on a number of occasions attention on animal behavior and this is for the entire veterinary staff available to them. It includes appropriate handling and also restraint of dogs, of cats and dogs. Now, with respect to other aspects of the bill, you know, the bill does address the boarding and kenneling of adult dogs, and it's come up a couple times in discussion today. It sets a requirement for an enclosure and prohibits the stacking of cages or kennels. And of course, if veterinary medicine was to be included, that is highly impractical, one, for space reasons, but also, you know, cats need to be up high. They like to be perched, so you'd have them in enclosures, but even many practices will have small dogs in enclosures, and I'll talk a little bit about that here too. I mean, it is common for practices to have those small dogs in stacked cages and more at eye level. Dogs can be inhibited, small dogs, if large dogs are walking by. It's also for the convenience of treatment, often to reach in, treat that animal, and perhaps for its own safety. And we talked with a couple of veterinary behaviorists that codify that for us when we were talking about that. And then the other thing is that while parts of the bill include both dogs and cats, Section 5 really focuses specifically on the housing of dogs. And I guess we just ask the question, you know, have cats been looked at as far as their housing? I think when we're looking at the traditional dog kennels, at least my experience in over the years bringing my dogs to a kennel, it's they have runs, indoor-outdoor runs. For dogs, there's a lot of open space, but now we've got more kind of pet hotels, boutique hotels, and boarding kennels. Some are for dogs, some are cat specific, and what kind of cages do they have? What kind of enclosures do they have for that? I think all that needs to be looked at, and it sounds from the interest the committee members have that you also would want to have that to be looked at. And so I guess I'll leave my comments at that and just welcome the opportunity to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Hansen, am I assuming that you're Dr. Hansen?
I'll answer your question. I don't have testimony.
I understand. But are you for the record, Dr. Moore?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Okay. I'm Co-Chair Wisnett and...
Wisnett.
Wisnett. Sorry.
That's okay.
I've got your senator friend down in...
Yeah. The other
there. Representative Holby. I'm Don Hansen. I'm the state veterinarian from the Department of Agriculture.
Thank you for coming up to the witness table. Thank you very much. So, committee members, questions of these three witnesses? Yes, sure. Representative Cameron.
Yes, Doctor, in your testimony, you were referring to alternative options that you recommend to your clients. Can you discuss some of those, what those would be?
As far as what I'm currently recommending, I have some staff that actually do pet sitting. As part of their moonlighting. There are also professional pet sitting services in the area that are licensed, bonded, that will go into homes and stay with the pets, give medications, treat the pet almost like being an owner, when the owners are away. So that tends to be what I recommend right now.
Follow up, if I may.
Yes, sir.
So they are licensed by the state or by the county, or can you talk a little bit about their
background? I have to say I don't know for sure, but it's usually a local licensing. It's my understanding that's the way it works, and they basically are insured. So in other words, they do have to have certain guidelines that they have to follow as well. And, of course, they're in somebody's home, so we're talking about personal items, that sort of thing that might be in jeopardy if you have somebody strange coming into your home. So they have, basically, they've covered themselves for liability on that as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Other questions? I'll have real... I'm sorry.
Oh, Mr. Chair, my question is actually of the committee. Are we going to use are we thinking about doing a committee bill for this? Is that...
We'll have to... I'm not sure, like Representative Steger, that we can see how we can get it done by then to put it on the schedule. So,
okay.
But I think it's something we want to work at and look at, and I think Representative Steger said for 2013, better chance. The big thing is physical impact, and like Representative Steger and Representative Hogley mentioned that in the last session. I'm Ways and Means, and we're probably looking already at $1 billion shortfall that we're going to have to address in 2013 or 2012. So anything that has, you know, a financial impact is going to have some concern. I had a question to Dr. Kettinger. Is there a protocol for veterinarians of to report abuse, and who do you report it to?
Yes, we are required, if we do see anything that's suspected of abuse, we're required to report it. In this last case, I actually talked to, there's a couple different ways you can go through it. You can certainly talk to the Humane Society, but usually I go right to the police. I mean, that's something we need to report. That's what I do.
Thank you. And
may I comment on that, too?
Yes, sir.
I appreciate that, Co-Chair Wisnik. Veterinarians are required to report suspected cases of aggravated animal abuse. That's the highest crime against animals in our state. We as an organization encourage veterinarians to consider reporting all kinds of abuse. There's different forms of abuse that don't hit that threshold, but we passed legislation, or we introduced legislation, the legislature adopted that both laws, and one would allow them to report that, and provided it's done in good faith, there's immunity for reporting that. And just as Dr. Kettering had said, reporting it to humane shelters or Oregon Humane Society or the sheriffs or the police, local authorities, is very important. We encourage them to do that.
Good. Thanks for that information. Representative Cameron.
Well, he was first.
How was that?
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Make him go last.
Representative Holby, thank you for letting me go through. Glenn, this is an off-the-topic question. Recently, it was brought to my attention that a veterinarian clinic can only be owned by a veterinarian. Is that accurate?
Co-Chair Wisnik, Co-Chair Holvey, Representative Cameron, that is correct at this time. At one time, a non-veterinarian would be able to have a partial ownership, or up to 49%, and we as an organization are looking to perhaps change Oregon law that would allow a non-veterinarian to own a veterinary practice. The key there is to wonder, how would that be regulated? Would it be through a premise permit and a holding fee, and where the Veterinary Licensing Board could pull that permit if that practice continues to have poor practice experience? Those are some of the things we're wrestling at, but we're looking at 2013 to introduce legislation.
Great. Look forward to hearing from you about that.
Thank you. Chair Helby.
Just a quick question for the Department of Agriculture, since they were kind enough to be here. I'm curious, does the Department of Agriculture have any authority over the humane treatment of animals?
No, we don't. This would be a unique bill, as our laying hen cage bill is. And so for me as a state veterinarian, I see perhaps a new page turning, and it's not just happening in Oregon, it happens all over, where the Department of Ag really steps into an authoritative role in animal welfare. This would, if this bill took on, didn't change much, that would push us more into that realm. Right now, that statute, as you know, it's an animal cruelty statute, and it belongs to the state police and law enforcement, Humane Society. But this directs us to take action, and that would be the first formal piece where the Department of Ag say, no, you guys go look. As opposed to what we've done in the past is supporting local law enforcement to do this kind of an investigation when they're called in to do it.
Follow up.
Yes, sir.
And I apologize for my memory, because I was the author of the bill that put regulations around breeders. And I lament right now that we didn't include kennels, but we did discuss it but could not get agreement to do that. So the standards and regulations around for breeders and housing dogs, the Department of Agriculture doesn't have any purview in that either.
Nope. There was a piece that wasn't there.
Right. Okay, thank you.
I'm glad that Co-Chair Holby brought that up, because that's, for this bill to move forward, that's going to have to be addressed. We're going to have to decide who is in charge of the regulations and the statutes, or putting the rules together. We're going to move that forward. You know, these are the two people who would have to decide there, or maybe our next witness. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Well, thank
and we'll
you
ask
time.
Up Sharon Hammond and Rodney Strand. Hoping Mr. Rodney Strand is from the Kennels and Breeders. I was hoping.
groomers and breeders. Good afternoon, Ms. Harmon. Identify yourself and please give us your concise testimony.
I will do my best. I'm Sharon Harmon. I'm the director of the Oregon Humane Society. We're a private agency in Portland, unaffiliated with any national or local group. A couple of points of clarification. When folks talk about reporting to the Humane Society, they must be talking about the Oregon Humane Society. We are the only Humane Society empowered to enforce state law, and that is bestowed upon us by the governor's office. We are a law enforcement division, and we would most likely be also responsible for enforcing this or responding to complaints of this violations. Animal abuse is against the law, and we have great laws on the books, and I hope that anyone who believes their pet has been abused promptly reports it. That being said, this bill offers a number of, we think, needed provisions to Oregon statutes to protect pets. There are some great boarding kennels. Has anybody been to the Sniff Dog Hotel? You get a glass of wine, your dog gets a massage. I mean, it's so over the top. But then there's the other side. Here, put your dog here. The place is good. Let me show you this sample kennel. This is where it's going to be. And then your dog's in a wire crate for while you're gone. That runs the whole gamut. We would very much like to see provisions for housing. And while we don't often talk about cats or sort of the forgotten species, we'd like to see protections for. Yes, they are. We'd like to see protections for cats. And there's a body of work that's already been done by the Association of Shelter Veterinarians that we could grab language for what is scientifically proven appropriate housing for cats. I fully support the background check provision. Our agency background checks every volunteer and every employee and every candidate for employment. To give you a sense of scope, that's about 1,600 volunteers and 150 employees. We take that on because we're looking for not only animal abuse, we're looking for interpersonal crimes and child abuse because we have so many kids programs. It's not onerous. It's about $22 a candidate. It's all computer, easy peasy, checks every record. It's not a burden on business.
I'd like to get that reference. The state's paying a lot more than that.
And it is in my testimony. Yes, you please use it. $22 a person to do it. But we feel, we know that, you know, animal abuse isn't a crime in a vacuum. We know that animal abuse is a serious interpersonal crime when it comes to the folks who do abuse animals go on to, on some occasions, abuse people. In fact, in an elder abuse work committee yesterday, it was discussed putting violations of animal abuse statutes as a prohibited crime that would prevent employment. It just seems like a common sense provision. It's not hard on business, and it makes good sense to me. I think if I'm giving my companion to someone else, it seems like the barest minimum is you could assure me that someone who hasn't been convicted of animal abuse isn't going to be caring for it. The reporting requirements are not difficult. We have care sheets on every one of the 350 animals in our custody. What did they get? What's their medication? These aren't difficult things. We would like to see the definition of Humane Society tightened up. In all honesty, I really don't know what a Humane Society is anymore. What's a rescue? What's a Humane Society? It'd be a better one to refer to, you know, municipal animal shelters and nonprofits organized under 501c3 of the federal tax code so that we have a level playing field. Because I don't know what a Humane Society is. Everybody's a Humane Society these days, or a rescue, and that's a scary business for another bill. I would be happy to work participate in a work group, provide any other assistance. My heart goes out to the Burtons. I've had conversations with them. I can't imagine what they've going through, and I appreciate their strength in coming forward and reliving this to tell you their story, and thank you for taking it seriously. If you have any questions, I'll be brief.
Questions, committee members? Thank you, Mrs. Harmon. I know that you think that the Humane Society in Redmond, they were having some difficulty probably during this time. They've reorganized and have a very effective program, I think, going now in Redmond. So I don't know if that contributed to this situation. Thank you for your testimony, and I think we've got a lot of people here interested in working on this bill, so we'll charge my friends from Central Oregon to keep after it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay, committee members, we've gone from dead bars to animal abuse to now funeral products and services.
So. Very strange mix, I've got to say today.
We cover everything here. So, Mr. Tatman and Mr. Can we bring up? Who else do we bring up? Should we bring someone else up with him?
With the committee's indulgence, I'd invite up Sarah Hackett. She's a policy analyst from this area.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
No, but he really wants to be.
Welcome to our committee. Please identify yourself and provide us your concise Friday afternoon testimony.
Thank you. Co-Chair Wisnett and Co-Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is David Tatman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and I've been appearing in front of this committee for several years now, and usually it has to do something around the area of depositories or mortgage brokers or something of that nature. This is one of the programs that we put in our non-depository program, and that is pre-needs and pre-need trust. You should have an electronic version of my testimony, and I will try and follow that to simplify matters. Given the hour where we're at, I don't want to presume too much in terms of the committee's patience, but I do want to take a few minutes to go over a couple of points I think are important. My hope is that you, as the saying goes, have saved the best for last, so we will try and make this worth your while.
And we have another one.
I apologize.
We have audits.
Okay, great. Well, I'm not the only one keeping you from closing business then. Our division has been charged with a very specific component of what I call the death care industry. And the death care industry essentially are those that provide services for people, obviously, at the time of death. So they could be cemeteries, they could be funeral homes, embalmers, morticians, and alike. Most of those activities are regulated by the agency in Portland, the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board, or OM. CB. Our specific charge is to address those situations where people in advance, or as we say, pre-time of need or pre-need, will seek to purchase services, typically to do that so that it's not burdensome at the time of death or it's not a difficulty. They get to plan everything out as they do that. And so they will buy services. Sometimes they buy it 100% up front, and sometimes they buy the services on a payment process. But the money is to go into trust, to be held for the time of need. Well, as you can imagine, depending on when the person makes the decision, there could be decades of time from the time of the purchase till the time of need. The only thing making sure that money is available is the ethics and the integrity of the company holding that money and the oversight by the state of Oregon. This is an area where its state regulation is the only regulator. The process itself, as I mentioned in my testimony, is specifically involves twofold parts. One, the certified providers. Those are companies, not individuals, companies that sell these pre-need items. And the items could be the services, so the funeral service itself, could be the cemetery. It's not the plot, but the cemetery services could be the headstone and so forth. And these services are purchased, and the money is obtained from, received by the certified provider, and then the funds are deposited into a trust account. And that trust account is managed either by a master trustee, which is defined in statute in ORS Chapter 97, or a financial institution, and then are available at the time the individual passes away. There are only 7 master trustees in the state of Oregon. Most of the work is done through financial institutions. But those 7 trustees run the gamut of trust companies or individual companies that have been organized, and you have someone testifying from the Oregon
Funeral Directors Association, which is a master trustee, so they can go further into the specifics of how they do things. It's their fiduciary duty to make sure that money is properly handled, and that the money is very clear about how they can, in the statute, how that money can be invested and what the proceeds from that money can be used for, and the obligations that the consumer has if he or she decides they want to cancel that program. So it's on paper, I think it's a pretty good system. The problem lies is that there are many opportunities for misappropriation of the funds and mismanagement of the funds at the initial process when the certified provider takes the money. It's very easy for them to write up a contract, and then that contract never gets properly filed, and the money never gets properly delivered. Right here, I've got a file of roughly, I'd say, 12 to 15 different cases over the past 18 months in which there has been defalcation, that is essentially theft of money, by people that were certified providers or people engaged in this activity across the United States. It's not a common problem when you realize how many contracts are written, but it's all too often a problem. And it's one of the things I really want to bring to this committee's attention is that this is a problem that adequate oversight is the only way to address. And candidly, I'm not sure we've got sufficient adequate oversight in that area. For instance, Oregon itself had a problem like this. Many years ago, there was a company out of the Albany area, the Twin Oaks Memorial Park, and you probably saw this, in which a couple bought the services, the business from the husband's parents, started running the business themselves, and lo and behold, they were taking money out. They were using money to buy real estate. They were using money to buy automobiles and other expenses. As I say, it's very easy to write a contract, and if we don't find that those contracts have been sequentially numbered and tracked, it's easy, if you jump around, to never know. Much like if you write a check and you don't do it in sequence, it's hard for you to know which checks you've written. Similar for anybody to track which of the contracts for trusted monies have been used. And in their case, they were taking money to the tune of about $400,000. As I said, there's usually a lengthy period of time between the time the contract's entered into and the time for the need. In this instance, decades passed. The company was sold a couple of times. Ultimately, as people were starting to die, it was in the hands of a second owner. This owner did not have the financial wherewithal, and the money wasn't in trust, so when people were dying, they didn't have the funds necessary to cover the costs of the funerals and the services that had been purchased. Out of the, if you will, his public willingness to serve or public good, he paid for a couple of funerals himself, but after a while he said, I just can't do this. And so we ultimately used what's known as the Consumer Financial Protection Trust to pay for a number of funeral-related services that we determined to be valid. Unfortunately, given the length of time, the statute of limitations had expired, and the couple were not criminally prosecuted. We just couldn't get there. We did take civil action. We've got a judgment against them. Should they ever have the financial wherewithal to repay the cost to that fund, we'll obtain that funding. But that's a pretty thin reed on which we hope to recover any funds. So that's an example just in Oregon. Well, magnify that or multiply that across the country, and it's a real problem. Now, as I mentioned, there's a component of oversight. In fact, the vast majority of death care oversight is done by the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and they license funeral homes, cemeteries, and crematories. They also license the individual salespeople who go out and sell the pre-need services. So you've got the Department of Consumer and Business Services licensing the company, and you got the Mortuary Board licensing the individuals, as well as they're the ones who are responsible for most of the death care. This is a formula that creates a fair amount of confusion and some degree of duplication, and frankly, we don't think that is the most efficient way for state regulation to take place in this area. In the past, we have called this a bifurcated process, and we think that that's problematic at times. We've seen this in other areas. I believe you heard from Mr. Marquis earlier today when he's talking about debt collection. The department licenses the debt collectors on behalf of a very limited scope, and that is to make sure the businesses that hire debt collectors receive the funding. The department has nothing to do with the consumer side of things. And anytime you have that bifurcation, you have consumers that are confused and things drop between the cracks. So we have a concern that this bifurcated process is problematic. I will tell you in all candor, we've brought this up several times with both the board and with the industry itself. And you've got a number of people from the industry, so I won't speak on their behalf. They can tell you their own concerns, but we have been told many times that they don't think that's the right way to go. I'm not quite sure why. I'm sure they'll have their reasons, but I think there's a lot to be said for efficiency. For example, the board has 6 full-time positions. We have 0.8 positions, so less than 1 full-time equivalent position. That 0.8 position is responsible for everything we do, which means it translates into an individual who has to process the various applications, handle consumer complaints. But when we do get out on an examination, is responsible for the examination, processes annual reports, and then we have a manager who deals with administrative matters in that case. And if we have any enforcement or if we have any situation that rises to the level of something like the Twin Oaks that I just described, that means my time gets involved and our enforcement unit's time gets involved. That 0.08, it doesn't even begin to stand up to that kind of regulatory oversight. And so we think the efficiencies are there, where you've got a board that's going out and doing regular examinations and has the opportunity to look at how businesses are handled, and at the same time could look at the pre-need trusting process and probably make a pretty fair determination if there's a problem and there needs additional follow-up. Unfortunately, without that type of coordination, I think we have a problem. A couple other things I just want to bring to the board's attention, and again, it sounds like I'm beating my chest in frustration, and that's not the case. It's the reality, and I think the reality has to be understood by this committee in terms of what we do. Last fall, we went through an administrative rulemaking process, and included in that was a fee process. And that fee process was, candidly, an attempt to raise our fee from $325 to $450. That would have given us another half an FTE. That other half an FTE, one half of a position, we would have just moved somebody over, reducing the responsibilities that that person had, and just have them do examinations to go out and do the compliance exams that we think are a fundamental need to make sure that people are complying with the various requirements that the law calls for. The fee was generally supported by the industry. They came in. We went through the process. And then, as you know, there's a process by which the legislature reviews any fee increase, and we went through that process, and House Bill 5014 reflected that fee increase. But at the time, the full fee increase was not supported, and, in fact, the fee was cut in half. So as of July 1st of 2011, our new biennia, the fee is now at $390. And so we are somewhere between 0.8 and 1.3, so we got approximately one position. And that, again, very challenging for us. As an alternative, though, to the merger that I've talked about, or the consolidation under the board of all death-related activities, we proposed a bill to try and strengthen the oversight and regulation. We said, okay, if we can't get there one way, we're going to try and do it the other way. And that bill was House Bill 2085 that was introduced as a governor's bill. And that bill was addressed to strengthen a number of aspects. I've given you, you can find the bill, obviously, but I've given you a bullet-pointed breakdown of the bill and key pieces. I will say the bill was worked through with industry. We spent a considerable amount of time meeting with both representatives of the cemeterians and representatives of the funeral industries. We worked with consumer groups. We worked with ARP and the Oregon Law Center. And we think we came up with a pretty good product that reflected essentially the concerns and needs of different groups. Rather than go through in great detail, what I'm going to do is just try and give you a quick summary for each of the bullet points. And now I'll just go through that very quickly. One of the concerns we have is, at this point, the law does not require licensing for those companies who are still administering pre-need trust, which is most companies that have sold a pre-need trust until the time of need, they can continue to administer it. And as I said, they may take payments or they may have been paid in full at the time of the initial purchase, but they continue to administer it, and they're the ones who ultimately will make sure the money is received at the time of death and put towards the funeral expenses. In reality, what they'll do is probably front that money and then collect the money after the services, but nonetheless, they're administering it. As the law currently reads, there isn't a requirement for them to continue to be licensed and therefore continue to be under our jurisdiction. And so once you're done selling, you're out from under that. You can go into what we call an inactive status. And we think that's problematic, and we think that the bill would have addressed that by just saying everybody, as long as you're involved in handling other people's monies and having authority to handle the affairs, the funeral affairs for somebody, you should still be subject to being overseen by us or regulated by us. We also had a component in there regarding guaranteed pre-need contracts, something that the industry asked us to address to make sure that once something is fully that guaranteed only meant that once somebody is fully paid, is that guaranteed. Until that time, they aren't obligated to provide those services if they haven't paid for 100%. Again, this is an industry who I admire for the fact that they do a lot of good for people who sometimes aren't financially able to come through, and they'll still pick up the cost. But I think they felt that by making it clear that guaranteed only means that all of the financial costs have been paid prior to the time of death was the only way to define guaranteed. We also wanted to make sure that we had at hand in determining who successor certified providers are. If a company went out of business or if a company was insolvent, we wanted to make sure that a company with a good reputation and the ability to handle the size and scope of business that may be involved steps in as a successor. So we asked that we play a role in that. Wanted to clarify the use of fees. Fees can be generated off the money that is held in trust. Interest is earned, sometimes not a lot in their current economic climate, but nonetheless, in most cases, some fees are earned, and we just wanted to be clear what those fees could be applied for by the certified providers and the master trustees. So again, we wanted to spell that out. We also wanted to talk about annual fees. Our annual fee language currently says, it allows us to set fees by rule, and as I said, we've exercised that. Current law says that we may set fees at a level that is, in quotes, reasonable and to defray the cost associated with the administration of the program. That's ambiguous language. Defray would suggest that it doesn't cover all our costs, but would help to cut them down, if you will, eliminate some of them. We think better language would be words that we see in other DCBS bills that we would be able to obtain the funding at levels sufficient to meet the cost of administration and have a reasonable emergency fund balance, which currently in our world is 1 to 2 quarters. Again, it would be done through the rulemaking process, so there's full opportunity to have any fee proposed vetted, and again, the legislature ultimately holds the authority under the 333 process by which they would have to approve the rule, and certainly showed last May that they will exercise that prerogative if they find the fee in their minds to be too excessive. The last thing I want to address in the bill was our Consumer Protection Trust Fund. As I mentioned, that fund is a fund that's designed, if you will, as a sinking fund that would allow for protection of consumers if a company can't meet their obligations. And we're sticklers about that. We come after the company hard and fast to make sure they're paying for those services regardless of their circumstances. However, the Twin Oaks case was a great example. There are times where a company just can't pay for because they're out of business, the owners are long gone, or they're in jail, or whatever the circumstances are. The fund is created by a $5 fee for every contract that's created, and that $5 fee then goes into this Consumer Protection Trust Fund. In the last few years, the fund has generated the number of contracts sold has generated about $40,000 a year. So it's not a considerably fast-growing fund. The fund itself is at about $1 million. But as I mentioned, in the last year, we took $250,000 out to pay for this Twin Oaks program. So we've lost approximately a quarter of the value of the fund. We're still in good shape with that fund. We're not asking for anything today. Our concern is, should we have another $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 hit to that fund, all of a sudden we're in a vulnerable situation, and we have no mechanism to build that fund back up. We sought with that bill to have the authority to come back and create some kind of surcharge to get the fund back up to what we would deem a reasonable level. Now, I know that many people are fearful when government talks about what's reasonable, and I probably wouldn't be resistive to the notion of putting in a cap of, or a floor in this case, of what level the fund has to be at before we could do that. Maybe it's $500,000, whatever it is. And we could work again on that issue. But I think it's important to make that fund viable and not have a couple of significantly big hits to it leave everyone else very vulnerable. In sum, that was a proposal of our legislation, and that was 2011. We're through that session. We obviously aren't going to be introducing that as a governor's bill in 2012. It's something I'd hope the committee would consider, but what I've tried to do today is, one, address what we see as some of the problem areas, our inability to go out and do examinations on a fairly regular basis. We have 225 certified providers. At the current rate, we've done 16 exams this year, and that's only because we had for a limited period of time, a fee increase, so we were able to get people out and do those examinations. At the current rate of 16 a year, we would be taking close to 20 years to get out and do all those exams. Well, that's almost meaningless. So what we really do is we respond when the public has a concern or the industry raises a red flag, and we have gone out and done what we call for cause exams. Second issue is, we think there's something to be said for the efficiencies and putting everything under a single roof. We understand there's concerns about that in opposition. We will continue to work on that. Again, that's something obviously the two regulatory agencies need to talk about. They're in transition right now. I want to talk to the governor about that. And lastly, there's a possibility of some legislation perhaps in the 2013 regular session. With that, I'm going to stop. I appreciate your indulgence, and I will take any questions, or I'm happy to sit back and let others come forward and come back at the end to answer questions.
Thank you, sir. Committee members, do you have any questions for Mr. Tatman or Mrs. Hackett? Representative Hope, Chair Hovey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. David, I appreciate you coming forward, and I followed this issue for a while. And I guess some of my concern are, it's kind of surprising to me we have these trust funds that really don't seem to have much oversight. And I know it doesn't happen very often, but it just seems like it was a few years ago there was an issue down in Eugene as well where some organization was sold that had, a huge obligation, and there wasn't a trust fund to match that obligation. And, you describing, how did that, had not the person that took over that organization come up with the money themselves to make good on it, how would the state have dealt with that issue?
Co-Chair Wisnant and Co-Chair Holvey, members of the committee, that was a very problematic situation for us. We're talking about multi-million-dollar companies. This was the Musgrove Funeral Home down in Eugene, and they had purchased from the largest funeral provider in the world, SCI. And the allegation was that not a sufficient amount of money was in trust. And in talking with members of the industry, that's a fairly notorious outfit. I don't know them personally, but I've heard that allegation raised by others that money isn't always properly trusted. But at the level of the problem of multi-millions of dollars not being properly addressed, They wanted our agency to come in and do a full-blown audit to determine how much was not properly trusted. The cost of bringing in someone with that level of expertise to spend that much time would have run us hundreds of thousands of dollars to do, and we just weren't in a position to do it. Fortunately, we, and this is where a lot of our administrative time goes, is working on things like this. Fortunately, we were able to work with our Attorney General and lawyers from both sides of the party and do a sufficient exam, if you will, to take a sampling to try and figure out what happened. The Musgrove Funeral Home continued to pay for the funerals as they came due, even though they couldn't always identify funding. There was money in trust. They just didn't think there was enough. When all was said and done, I think it was virtually a wash between what should have been in trust and what was in trust it probably shouldn't have been. And so the parties settled out their differences, and I think Musgrove was satisfied that they weren't, I think they got some dollar amount, if you will, in satisfaction, maybe for legal costs or whatever. But ultimately, they were able to resolve that. Should we have been in that situation, though, where we didn't have that kind of resolution, the state would have been in very dire consequences. All we could do is either have the Attorney General's office sue them and try and recover costs down the road, or we could use that Consumer Protection Fund to pay for the investigation and ultimately litigation to recover those funds. That's, in my personal view, is a roll of the dice. I don't want to play dice or roll the dice when we're talking about something like the Consumer Protection Trust Fund. That's there to protect people, and we shouldn't be using that to try and go after people who may have made a mistake. So that was very problematic. I do want to say those seven master trustees, for the most part, as fiduciaries, when they've got the money, I'm not too concerned about it. It's if somebody sells a contract, did they trust the money, put the money in trust or not? That's where the concern would lie. And only by examining will we know that.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Committee members, okay, we have some other, we still have other people to testify. Thank you, sir. And Mrs. Hackett, you got off easy, huh?
Yeah.
Mr. Cochran, Mr. Stein, and Mr. Dusselhaus, do you want to come up, please? Dusselhaus. What? Go ahead, sir, and introduce yourself and provide us your concise testimony on this issue.
Co-Chair Wisnett, Co-Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Ty Cochran. I'm with the Cemetery Association of Oregon. I've been in the industry for 27 years, and I have to agree with what Mr. Tapman has said here today. It's a very complicated statute, RS 97, and it's also complicated when you get into something like the Musgrove thing in Eugene. I happen to work for Service Corporation International. It's fortunate that they had the funding to come back and rectify that, or it would have been a very horrendous thing here in Oregon. As far as the Cemetery Association of Oregon goes, it's our intent to see that the consumers of Oregon are protected and that the trust funds are monitored and audited so that there's a reasonable assurance that down the road those trust funds are going to be there. It's also our intent to see that the endowment care funds are there when they're needed. It's our intent to see that the Consumer Protection Fund is sufficient to make good on cases of theft and where insufficient funding has taken place. The only way this can occur is if the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities has the funding available to do their job. And who better to tell us this than them? The fees that they have structured, they are reasonable, we believe. We do trust the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities to... We trust them. They've always included us in their rulemaking process. If there is a concern about the Division of Finance Corporate Securities increasing fees arbitrarily, yes, there is by rulemaking, but once again, they've always involved us in the rulemaking process and we've always supported them. The CAO, Cemetery Association of Oregon, feels that the consumers of Oregon have a reasonable protective barrier to see that this type of pre-need funding and consumer protection is indeed in place, the entire industry is better served. More importantly, that the consumers of pre-need trusting in Oregon are protected. Once again, we would like to see House Bill 2085 introduced either in the interim session or going. We're in full support of it, but we also would ask that there be a little clarification on page 11. page 26. In the last few days, we've talked to several of our members, and I think Mr. Steen also had some concern about what that actually means. So if we could get some clarification on that from Mr. Tapman, we'd appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Steen.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. Mark Steen with the National Funeral Trust Service. I thank you for the opportunity to come and discuss this today. We have some general concerns, specifically, I guess, with 2085 regarding over-regulating of this industry. And what's important here is that consumers currently have a choice. They don't, not all funeral homes or cemeteries use trusts. Some of them use cemeteries, use insurance companies. And so as a trust company, we compete with several large pre-need insurance companies in this state. And so the more regulation and the more fees associated with this fund, that's going to push funeral homes and cemeteries to not offer trust and to offer insurance instead. And that gives the consumer less choices. You know, over the years, there have been some instances, as already been talked about, but what's important there is that in all of these cases, no consumers have been harmed financially. Funeral homes or cemeteries or large corporations have stepped up and handled these funerals and cemeteries at the time of need. DCBS does currently have the ability to audit, and they are doing that. And we as a master trust, we have an independent audit performed every year. And in addition, funeral homes currently are regulated or oversight by several other agencies. And so again, our concern is just maybe a general concern about over-regulation and more fees. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dressler House?
Yes.
You gave us your testimony. Can you summarize that real quick?
Absolutely. And
thank you.
I will. Thank you, Co-Chairs Wisnett, okay. Holvey, committee members, and committee staff. Appreciate the opportunity. To summarize, basically, we have two points that we'd like to be discussed that could possibly be included with 2085. Number one is currently the allowable fee. It doesn't really address new business. It addresses at a calendar January 1st calendar date, but does not take into consideration new business if we get a new firm, new funeral home, new cemetery, or a current participating funeral home cemetery writes a great deal of business during the year. There is no opportunity for collection of funds, although we would still be obligated to pay a financial institution, an investment manager, and a master trustee. They don't work for free, although sometimes we do in those situations. So we just encourage, we provided a couple rewritings, suggestions that address that, to where it addresses that issue. The second one is to follow up with what Mr. Steen has stated regarding what other options consumers have, basically pre-need trust and pre-need funeral, or I'm sorry, pre-need trust and pre-need insurance. We are basically right at this point right now, those who sell pre-need trusts, as long as the contract is guaranteed, the seller may retain 10% of the contract price. Our competition, they can typically pay commissions that are higher than that. So we are suggesting that maybe the retainage, the amount that the pre-need seller can retain upon the sale, increase to provide options for consumers to continue to be competitive and to not price us out of the market. So I appreciate that. If any questions.
Thank you very much. You're representing?
I'm with American Funeral and Cemetery Trust Services. We are one of the seven master trustees. AFCTS as well as OFDA, we are the only two non-financial institution master trustees.
Thank you. Okay, committee members, that was sort of good testimony and concise. I appreciate it. But sounds like we're still not all together on 2085. But
A quick one,
Chair.
I appreciate you coming forward, and I know there's some differences on there, and I'd like to you know, maybe a later date, try to hone in on the issues that you raised about, you know, being a level playing field out there, you know, and how you see, you know, we don't want to price anybody out of a market they're currently in. That doesn't make too much sense. So, you know, I want to be very sensitive to that. So if there's some way we can figure out how to work with that, I appreciate you looking at this in that realm and bringing proposed changes that and identifying what really the issue is there, I suppose, with you know, making sure that we don't put so much regulation on it that you're at an unfair advantage again. We don't, you know, there ought to be a way to do this without doing that, is all, I guess what I'm trying to get at.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments, committee members? Thank you for your testimony. Have a good weekend. Safe travels. Have one final person to testify on this issue is Andrea Augustin. With Legal Aid Services of Oregon. Thank you very much. Identify yourself and provide us your concise testimony. Have a good.
It will be very concise. Co-Chair Wisnett and Co-Chair Holvey, thanks for taking the time to hear my comments. So I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, and I work specifically with elders. So where Legal Aid, where our work intersects with the pre-need plans is we frequently help people go into Medicaid, and as part of their Medicaid application, they're allowed to purchase a pre-need plan. So typically when a family is going to put a person on long-term care services, there's a really acute situation going on, either physically or mentally, or just the emotional strain of leaving your home. And so you have a really vulnerable population that's purchasing these pre-need contracts. So for that reason, it's especially important to have regulations that are very clear about what constitutes fraud and that consumers have a centralized place to go to deal with issues that they may have. I think that in general this is a very ethical area of business, but I do see cases, for example, I recently met with a wife who had purchased a pre-need plan with her husband, and when it came time to bury her husband, which again is another very stressful time, so if there were issues with the initial contract that they, you know, entered into during a stressful time and now the person's passed away, she felt that what had been represented to her was very different to what was actually in the contract. And so helping her figure out how to raise that issue, it's helpful to have one entity regulating those contracts. And I think those are all of my comments.
Very good. Thank you very much. Questions of Mrs. Augustin? Committee members? So you're not seeing a big issue with this in the state of Oregon, but it's an issue of concern.
I'm not, because I only really deal with it on the front end, so it would be hard for those cases to come back to me.
Good. Thank you for your testimony. Okay. Mr. Tatman, are you planning on bringing this, asking this committee to look at this for the, you want to come up to the table, please? If, it seems like we still got some issues, but just briefly, if we, you know the deadlines, and if you can, you know, think it's something we can do in 2012, you're going to have to really work hard with this to get to
Mr. Co-Chair, excuse me, Mr. Co-Chair, candidly, the governor gets five bills. We're not going to be seeking this as one of those five bills. If the committee was pursuing this as one of the committee bills, we would work with the committee, but we will not be using this through the executive branch. Come 2013, we'll have to look at the lay of the land, but we'd certainly want to work with the committee. We think there's a lot to be done. We were very close, I thought, on 2085 before. The few issues you heard were really, I think, minor issues and could definitely get smoothed out. As I said earlier, and I hate to reiterate that, but as I said earlier, there are probably different options. We're here certainly to work.
I guess my direction, and ask the co-chair to support me or not, to say it doesn't support me, but we really need you to work with the stakeholders and tell me if you can, if it's going to be agreement. We don't want to submit one of our five bills and it die on the floor, so or die in committee. So if that's my charge or challenge to you, that this 35 days is going to be hard.
Agreed.
Sure, Hobie, you want to
Well, I think there is a real need to do something about this. And, you know, I think that the industry has expressed that, and I think there's a willingness there to try to figure this out. I don't think that it's terribly... I would hope that the stakeholders would have a conversation and see if there is something to do, because I think there is a lot of good things that could come out of this bill that would help the industry and consumers and potentially save us some duplication of government services and potentially save us a little bit of money. So that's sort of how I see it, which basically saves the industry because it's all fee-based.
Well, I'm sorry, we're going to pass the ball to you, and can you let us know if you think we can come up with something?
Happy to do that, and maybe we could get somebody to assist with that. We find that that's a pretty good tool to have somebody with the title representative in front of their name to help move things along. So we will get back to you. We'll have a conversation, obviously, and report back, probably through your committee administrator.
That would be great. Thank you, sir. We've been looking for this one all day, Mr. Blackmer. Would you please come?
The best for last.
Yeah. Good afternoon. Please provide us your concise Friday afternoon testimony. Identify yourself.
Co-chairs Wisnett and Holvey, thank you very much for inviting me and members of the committee. Gary Blackmer, director of the Secretary of State.
Everybody here is really looking forward to hearing you talk. I mean,
actually, my entourage left for the day already, I think. What I'd like to do is give you a real quick snapshot of the kind of work we're doing and then just kind of leave it open to some questions. So I'll try and be very, very brief. And I've been here a little over 2 years now, and I'm really proud to be part of an organization that provides as diverse and, I think, significant services to the state of Oregon government as well as Oregonians. Let me kind of put a framework around this, saying that our audits look for the most critical problems in an agency. And those problems can be a wide variety of issues. And we have auditors with a wide variety of expertise and software and analytical skills that can come up with solutions that actually help agencies get better. But let me start by kind of talking about categories of audits. I'll talk about what I would call bedrock audits. Those are audits that talk about the basic, fundamental, critical things that agencies need to be responsible for. First of all, managing their money wisely, accounting for it properly, that they need to be able to account for their dollars consistently with generally accepted accounting practices. They need to follow rules and regulations. They need to maintain the integrity of their computers and security of the data. So those are all kind of what I would say critical, fundamental things that every agency needs to make as a top priority, and we expect it to be very close to ship shape when we come in there. And when we don't, we tend to be a little more blunt with them because from our standpoint, we think the greatest value that we can serve and they can serve is to focus on quality of their performance, assuming that everything else is in place. So let me just kind of talk briefly about some of those bedrock type audits. Literally half of our resources go every year to auditing the financial statement of all the agencies of the state and looking to ensure their compliance with federal guidelines and regulations regarding dollars that the state of Oregon receives. That means we're auditing in detail over 200 accounts, looking at $15.3 billion in revenues, $14.9 billion in expenditures, $10.5 billion in liabilities. We're out there looking at a lot of agencies, and we get a sense of how well they're managing those. And we, in the sense of us doing our audits, we also point out areas that they can learn and get better at. You expect our agencies to comply with payroll, procurement, hiring, asset management, and other rules that the state and federal government established. And we routinely audit those as well, not only in our financial statement audits, but in our federal compliance to make sure that the dollars are spent wisely, because they may require a little extra work from the agencies, but ultimately they provide assurance to the public that the money is being wisely spent, that we're getting the best price, the best quality services or goods, and so forth. So we look to make sure that agencies comply with those. We report those issues that are of concern. Just as one example, we conducted an audit of the Oregon State Marine Board, and this was at the request of the governor's office, and we found a large number of transactions that did not comply with state rules or policies. We questioned the appropriateness of some of their expenditures. We found equipment services were improperly acquired, state property was improperly disposed of, and assets were not always safe. Guarded. A new director came in and committed to major changes in their practices as a result of our audit. We found a similar pattern of problems in the Willamette Education Service District and issued an audit in January 2010. We went back a year later and assessed their progress, and we found and reported on many substantial improvements. They had more work to do, which we expected, because there was a lot that needed to be done. And we also recognized that they were continuing to work on it. That follow-up is something that we're doing now that's different than in the past. In agencies where we think that we have given them a particularly challenging set of recommendations, that they're big and difficult, or we get a sense that the agency does not necessarily see the importance of our recommendations, we're going to go back and visit them. Also, if it's a very critical area, high risk, high stakes kind of a topic area, we will come back as well. Just from our standpoint, we think that timely response to recommendations is in the best interest of Oregonians. The WESD audit is an example of something else, which is we actually audited a non-state agency. The state depends a lot on counties, school districts, cities to carry out major responsibilities. And it also passes large amounts of money to those jurisdictions. With that money, you have accountability questions. And those are things that we believe we can answer as well. It's difficult to cover almost 200 school districts, many hundreds of cities, and the 36 counties. In fact, there are about 1,600 local governments in Oregon. So we have to be selective about it. But we are looking at another bedrock function that they have, which is they hire private CPAs to come in to do their financial statement audit. And we look at the quality of those audits to make sure that they're getting a good audit done on the organization. That way, their leadership knows if they're having financial problems. One of the other things that we look at in terms of bedrock is information systems. In fiscal year 2010, the Department of Human Services processed $2.6 billion in Medicaid transactions through a brand new computer system, the Medicaid Management Information System. We went through that system in detail because it was new and we wanted to make sure it was functioning properly. Here's the key findings in that IT audit. We found that computer controls reasonably ensured the validity, completeness, and accuracy of Medicaid payments. Computer code modifications followed appropriate processes, and the system and data were adequately protected. They don't make headlines, but I think we all sleep a little better when we know that we've got a system with that large of a transaction each year that is working properly. So let me go a little beyond the bedrock to those higher kind of issues going from the back office to the front lines in terms of what the agencies do. And where we can have the most impact, I think, dollar-wise, in terms of quality of service, timeliness of service, is when we're looking at the efficiency and effectiveness of those services provided to the public. I'll run through a few to give you kind of a sense of the variety. We looked at the Department of Environmental Quality, and we focused on their laboratory operations. Now, they have a state-of-the-art laboratory, but when we looked at it, it really appeared that they were underutilizing it. There was excess capacity there, that the timeliness of their lab tests was not as good as it could be, and we started looking at why that was happening, and we identified a number of causes, and what we recommended was that the lab establish a costing methodology for its tests, and charge it back to the divisions within DEQ, as well as marketing it to outside organizations, forestry, agriculture. A number of agencies have lab testing done, and in many cases, it goes to out of state. In fact, we found that the lands division within DEQ, because of timeliness problems, was actually sending its lab testing out of state to be done. So we felt like if they had a better handle on their budget and they could actually turn it into an enterprise operation, that they could actually go out and market it. And if they could increase their capacity by 20%, which we think they can do, and maybe more, that would save them $700,000 a year in general fund dollars. That essentially, that inefficiency is costing an extra $700,000 a year in general fund dollars. We looked at the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. That has been in operation for many years now, and we wanted to look and see what had happened in the last 10 years. So we reviewed what they had been doing and their strategy for looking at watershed enhancement. And they really approached it from a community-based viewpoint, that they needed to have watershed councils, they needed to work with property owners, soil and water conservation districts, and build them the kinds of resources to help them care for their watersheds. And that investment has provided, I think, a great foundation, and there are many organizations out there that are taking the initiative to protect their watersheds. We talked with many, many people. We did not find anything of substance that we could criticize in terms of what they were doing there. What we did was we said, well, what more could they do? And we looked at how they were tracking their projects and the condition of the streams, and they had been working at that, but we said, you need to kind of solidify your monitoring and measurement of stream conditions and track that. And they're moving into a data system now, that a GIS system that allows them to map out all their streams and the projects on it and do it statewide. But we also said you need to start looking at a watershed level and start setting priorities for those barriers for fish passage, for problems in the streams, and be able to address those. And they embraced those. They said, you're right, we've reached a point where we've got the community organizations out there. Now we really need to start setting priorities. And so that was a very positive audit, I thought, and actually was an opportunity to talk about something that had been, that the state had done that was good. But obviously there's a huge amount to be done to complete all the watershed restoration in the state. The legislature asked us to look at earn time credits, as well as the cost savings from earn time credits and any recidivism impacts that might come from that. So we looked in detail at the processes and procedures about granting earn time. We interviewed extensively the staff there. We looked for outliers. And ultimately, we found that there were explanations for those, and that, in general, they were complying with the laws that were passed by the legislature regarding the compliance with earned time credits, as well as their own internal procedures. We looked at the impact, the dollar impact in fiscal year 2009, the savings from early release, and estimated that it was $29 million. And we didn't have enough data and enough time to be able to assess recidivism, but we did a thorough literature search, and we found other programs around the country that had not seen any impact on recidivism from inmates who were released earlier as a result of earning credits. We could not verify for sure that would also play out in Oregon, but in general, what we saw was that these kinds of earn time programs did not have a negative impact on crime rates. One of the other challenges as a state is we are looking at programs where we're sharing responsibilities with counties. We looked at the juveniles that are sent to the state's youth correction facilities. The decisions made on who goes to those facilities are made by 170 judges in 36 different counties. Our big question was, is that being done consistently? Are the right kids being sent to our facilities because they're expensive? We want to not have low-risk children being put in with high-risk youth. So we wanted to make sure that the decisions were done consistently. On the adult side, we have sentencing guidelines that arose because of disparities in sentencing practices for adults. We looked at 3,315 youth and the decisions that were made by those judges and ultimately concluded that they were pretty consistent. It wasn't the answer we expected to find with that kind of disparity of resources county to county, but ultimately it was good news. The system that's out there is working as it's intended. Didn't get a lot of play, but again, I think it's something important for you to know that if you have concerns about the sentence or the decisions about juveniles and where they go, we'd be more than happy to talk to you about our audit and what we found there. Let me share one last thing, which we don't often do a fancy printing job on our reports, but this is something we hope that everyone will take with them, share with other people, because this is a financial condition report that explains where the money comes from in Oregon, where it's spent, what kind of debts and liabilities we have, and we try to do it. Thank you. We try to do it in a graphical way so that you can see the trends over a 9-year period. The irony is most of this information comes from our annual financial audits, and we look at it, it's a snapshot each year. What we did was we put those snapshots together into a moving picture. So you see trends that occur, and you see waves of revenues and expenditures, and it's a great way to get an understanding of what we've inherited in terms of our financial condition. And I'm hoping it helps us think a little more long-term in terms of the decisions that the legislature makes each year, each biennium, has a long-term impact. And it's also the decisions that you make are constrained by what previous legislatures had decided. So this is something that jurisdictions have done. I prepared one for the city of Portland and for Multnomah County, and they've sustained it every 2 years since then because it's a way to see the broad patterns of issues, and it includes demographic and economic information as well. So you can see poverty, you can see per capita income, ages, kind of the demands that are put on the state as well as kind of the resources in terms of a tax base and so forth. So this is one that I hope also informs you. So that gives you kind of a quick flavor of the diversity of our audits that we do, and I leave it open to any questions you have, or if you have other things you need to do, that's fine too. I'll be back, I suspect.
Thank you very much, Mr. Black. I apologize. This is something I have a lot of interest in, and I'm sure the late hour that we're not spending the time we should on this. But thank you for the report. I'm sure that we'll probably be talking to you more in the past. Committee members, any specific questions for Mr. Blackburn? I'll be following up with you. I want to hear more. I'm sorry. I didn't see that. Did someone have a question?
You never see that.
Chair Colby.
Yeah, I just...
It was not intentionally, you know.
Yeah, I know. It never is. I just wanted to thank you for coming forward, and I know we've had a couple of conversations about your office and your work and your audits, and, you know, when I'm thinking about all the things you're talking about, I'm trying to... I don't want to audit you, but it seems maybe it's the legislature is how do we have a better connection with the outcomes or your recommendations that come out of your reports for government and make sure the legislature is, you know, aware of the recommendations and their financial impacts to the state going forward. To help better, I guess, inform us about the decisions we make. And, you know, you do an incredible job of putting things on the website. Certainly, you probably can't find every audit on the website, but there's a lot of them on there. And I'm just kind of curious what you see as the impediment and maybe there isn't one. I'm kind of curious what you find as far as government agencies responding to your recommendations and, you know, carrying out those recommendations to find better efficiencies, and how could we better involve the legislature in that process?
Thank you for the question, Co-Chair Holvey and Co-Chair Wisnant. We send out a little email to all the legislative offices, and we're going to work on trying to put a little more information in it. And I would encourage you to just read the quick little summary that we've got, and sometimes it gets a little longer because we cover a lot of topics, but it gives you a sense of what the audit's about. If you are intrigued by it, read the audit report. There's a lot more information in that. If you are even further intrigued, give us a call. We'd love to talk to you about it, just to give you more insights into what we found in the organization and kind of the scale of it. Because we encounter agencies that will bring something to them and go, you're right, we need to do something about it. We'll encounter other agencies that are reluctant or resistant. And for us to be able to kind of work with those agencies to encourage them is one of the other things we'd like. I guess another thing is, if you get calls in your office and you start hearing a pattern of problems about an agency, we'd love to hear that also. We can't handle an individual complaint, but if there are issues that you start hearing, you know, that's the fourth call we've gotten about such and such agency in this topic, let us know, because a lot of times we can go in and look at what's causing those complaints and solve them on a systemic level. So that's another way that we'd love to hear from you. And I guess the legislature passed a law that the agencies are going to report to the Ways and Means Subcommittees about the recommendations that we've made and what actions they've taken. That's there to hold them accountable. But it's also something, I think sometimes we put recommendations in there that you know, a revision to their computer system or something is required, and it may take a while to get there, but we won't forget about it, and we hope you don't, in terms of cost, because there are resource limitations. And I guess lastly, if an agency has really implemented the recommendations, I think that's something that they could appreciate some recognition for, that, you know, it's a good news for everybody that they've made things better. And that's something that it's great for. I mean, they'll be walking a little bit higher off the ground if they know that they've been recognized for doing something good and that it's made everyone's lives better. And so I think that's another thing that the legislature could do in those hearings. So,
and just one specifically, and I apologize, I could probably have found this out by researching, but this committee was looking into a problem that the state has with addressing deferred maintenance around the state. And I'm curious whether the Secretary of State's office has ever looked at deferred maintenance and done an audit or a review or made any recommendations about how we deal with that.
We have been working with the agencies to help them better assess the condition of their facilities and putting it into monetary terms in their financial statement. That was a major accounting change that happened in, actually, why this is only a 9-year review instead of 10 years. There's a huge revamp of how the financial statements were portrayed, and within that was a requirement that assets of a government be reported, not just liabilities, and assets being their all of the infrastructure and land. And so all the agencies were required to start reporting on condition and the investments they make to raise the quality. So we have been working on that, and there are dollar figures to that, but even the Government Accounting Standards Board recognizes that that's a very difficult thing to be able to put into hard dollars, or even into some metric that measures condition. But it's usually one of the first things that is cut when there are financial constraints, and that's not a known in any government entity, and I suspect that it's happening these days with the constraints that all the states are facing. And it's something that if we report on it, it just says, well, there's something more we can't afford. And to a certain degree, we're trying to figure out how we can stretch what we've got. So we do look at construction contracts and project management and so forth to see what we can do to stretch those infrastructure dollars we do have.
Thanks. Okay, thank you. Yes, Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say thank you. The agency did a terrific job with constituent issue of mine that was very contentious, where they were blaming the local school board for all sorts of mismanagement, and it was causing all sorts of strife in the community. Your office stepped in and debunked a lot of those claims, and I have not heard a peep out of them, which I hope means that they're satisfied that that everything was unfounded. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Blackman. Committee members, for the good of the order, I want you to know that Co-Chair Hovey and I, we've had a couple work groups about public contracting, and we're trying to finalize that to see if we can get a coalition that worked on on that in 2003 to move something on that. We'd have something maybe in 2013. Also, I'd like to remind everyone that December the 5th is deadline for individual committee bills, and at this time, as far as I know, that Chair Hovey and I have not agreed on any committee bills. So if you have ideas or things you want us to move forward, let us know. And Chair Hovey, do you have any comments?
Just one comment about that. Though we have not agreed on any, we have not disagreed on any yet either.
That did make it sound kind of adversarial.
No, that's
just wanted to clarify that.
Good point. Thank you for that.
Start talking then.
Exactly. But I think it was a good meeting, and we could have got a little early, but have a safe travel home, and thank you for all your work today and support. Jefferson, any comment?
Really good to see you guys.
You've been real quiet. Yeah, we appreciate that.
I know he's been paying attention.
Committee is adjourned. Safe travel. Thank you for your work.